Welcome to Class Matters, an educational program examining the role played by social classes and the class divide in the U.S. and around the world. I'm Rich Whitney.
I'm Paula.
We discuss matters of class because class matters. And today on Class Matters, wanted to touch upon a subject that has been of interest in the news lately, actually not too much lately, but at least in the days following March 26th, when we all heard about how a cargo ship called the Dolly slammed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore and caused major, major structural economic damage as well as the loss of some human lives. It's a disaster.
The bridge just collapsed like dominoes. It was absolutely amazing. It looked like the ship just bumped it. And I understand that the ship is heavy.
Right.
But it bumped one support and the whole bridge falls within seconds.
Yeah, yeah. It was startling
bizarre.
And shocking.
Yeah.
Yes, many
absolutely
other things.
Bizarre.
And to provide something of a class analysis on this, both on looking more incisively at the causes of the disaster as well as what to do about it, we'd like to today turn back to Ellen Brown. We haven't covered anything by Ellen Brown in a while, but she is probably best known as being an advocate for public banking, the idea that the monetary system should not be in the control of a cabal of private banks, but should be a public function.
And that money should be created without interest, because if you keep creating money that has to be repaid back, where does the interest come from?
Yeah.
You have to keep creating more money, which, oh, what is that called? I know, inflation.
Right, right.
And people complain about the inflation, but they don't complain about the debt-based monetary system, which is like bizarre.
Yeah, yeah. So, in any event, we wanted to share with you her perspective on this, and it's kind of a wide-ranging article, as we'll see, but I think you'll find it of interest. She begins with a little bit of an historical view of the situation, writing that the Baltimore Bridge that collapsed on March 26 was named for Francis Scott Key, who wrote the lyrics to the American National Anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner, in 1814. His inspiration was the British bombardment of Fort McHenry in the critical port of Baltimore during the War of 1812. The British had just burned the U.S. Capitol and the White House and had set their sights in the Baltimore port with the guns from hundreds of British ships trained on shelling the American flag. If the flag were taken down, they would know the Americans had surrendered and the British agreed the shelling would stop. But in the dawn's early light, the flag still waved, held up by patriots who replaced the soldiers who had fallen before them. Francis Scott Key observed all this from a British ship on which he had been allowed on board to negotiate a prisoner release. It's quite a moving story dramatized here, and she's got a link if you want to read that. By the way, you can find this article at ellenbrown.com. What the dawn's early light brought on March 26, 2024, by contrast, were shocking news videos of the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsing when the Singapore-owned cargo ship Dolly slammed into it. It was like something out of an action movie, said Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott. Several commentators are calling it a black swan event that will have catastrophic effects on global supply chains.
They should have the Russians build it. When the United States
right.
tried to blow up the Kerch Bridge, I mean, they used actual explosives. The Russians had it fit, and then they damaged it big time. But the whole bridge didn't fall down.
Right.
Just the part that they damaged was damaged.
Right.
And the Russians had it fixed within a couple of months, I think.
Yeah.
Because the whole bridge didn't fall down. So maybe they need to hire the Russians to come over here and replace that bridge.
Well, or they could build a bridge to better engineering specs that don't assume that a ship will not hit it.
Which is hilarious.
Right.
One of the busiest ports in America. What they did was they made sure that it could hold trucks, the weight of trucks.
Right.
But a ship accidentally hitting one of the supports? What are the odds of that happening?
Yeah, well.
Yeah, duh.
Well, we just found out, didn't
yeah.
we? Interestingly, Ellen Brown continues, the War of 1812 was also about disruptions to U.S. trade with foreign nations, in that case by blockade by the British Navy. But more on that, on how our forebears turned dependence on foreign manufacturers into economic independence, after a look at what went amiss with the Dolly and the bridge. Before it fell, the Key Bridge was a pivotal artery for traffic, cargo, and supplies across the country. The Interstate 695 running across the bridge connects to I-95, one of the country's busiest and most important supply chain highways, running from the northern to the southern end of the eastern seaboard. And then she's got a bunch of links there, including one that says that rebuilding the bridge to appropriate standards could take 5 to 7 years. This means the strategic artery will no longer be accessible for transporting hazardous materials, which Maryland law forbids to be transported by tunnels, including unleaded fuel, propane gas, and nitrogen chemicals for fertilizer, along with oversized cargo that cannot fit through roadway tunnels in the area, including tractors and military vehicles.
Well, here, oh boy, without military, oh man, they're going to be in big trouble. But here's what they're going to do, mark my words. They're going to make it legal for them to transport dangerous chemicals through the tunnel.
Yeah.
And then there's going to be an accident. What?
Yeah.
Who would ever thought that there would be a crash of a tanker?
Yeah.
And that all of this hazardous material would be spilled and all these people in the tunnel died. No one could have foreseen that, is what they'll say.
Yeah, yeah. I could see that one coming.
Yeah, me too.
Observers contend there is still no plausible explanation for the direct hit to the bridge's most critical support. The power went out on the ship about 3 minutes before the strike, yet multiple layers of security for maintaining steering control are mandated by U.S. and international regulation. Even without power, the dolly should have continued in the direction it was headed, but instead it veered to the right for a direct hit into the key pylon supporting the bridge.
I actually saw, reading Moon of Alabama comments, as I want to do, there was actually engineers and people who had worked on ships for years were saying how it could happen. Well, obviously it did happen. So I'm just saying there is a way it could happen.
Yeah.
Without Bigfoot or the sea monster pushing it.
Right, right, exactly. Engineering professor emerita W.M. Kim Rodas, a registered professional engineer with experience in bridge design, acknowledged in an interview in a March 28th article on GW Today that it was a one-in-a-million occurrence. As reported in the George Washington University publication, she was asked how a 1.6-mile-long bridge that carried 31,000 cars per day could suffer such a complete collapse. She responded, quoting her now, "The container ship dolly lost power multiple times on its way out of Baltimore Harbor. The ship's inability to steer resulted in it heading at an angle toward the southwestern major bridge pier, the pylon. The navigation chart for Baltimore Harbor shows four protective devices called dolphins, one in front of each pier for outgoing and incoming ships. They essentially serve as bumpers to deflect or slow boats and ships that are headed toward the pylon. The dolly's angled course allowed the ship to miss the dolphin and strike the pylon. When the ship collided with the pylon, it exerted a huge crushing force on the pier, bursting the pylon apart. This pylon was the only support for the bridge on that side. The continuity of the structure meant that all three spans came down when the southwestern pylon was lost."
Okay, well, that sounds like bad engineering to me.
Yeah.
It shouldn't do that. They should each support their own. It shouldn't be, okay, well, this one right here, this one can hold up all the rest of it.
Yeah, right.
It's like, what?
Yeah, that does seem like a design failing.
It does. If she's an engineer and she misses that, well, you know, it didn't go by the dolphin. Okay, but then why did the whole thing collapse?
Right.
Well, because that one was holding it all up. Right there, that's the problem.
Yeah, and to be fair, who knows what else she wrote about in this article, but still, she was focusing on this. The angle the ship came in at was unusual, so yes, this was an unlikely accident. One in a million is in the right ballpark.
Well, it took, 40 years? 50 years.
Yeah.
So, yeah. After a while, enough monkeys typing, you come up with Shakespeare.
There you go.
I doubt that, but still, that's what they say.
Yeah. The FBI issued a statement the morning of the dolly crash saying there was no evidence of a terrorist attack, but insurers and reinsurers will no doubt be investigating since insurance contracts now typically exclude damage from terrorist attacks. Insurance claims are expected to be high and to spill over into the global reinsurance market. An interesting bit of trivia is that Dolly's insurer, a company named Britannia, is owned by a company called Wadia Group, Founded in 1726, it built the ship from which Francis Scott Key saw the flag waving over Fort McHenry in 1814.
Wow, that is a bit of trivia.
Yeah.
That is interesting.
Weird full circle thing.
But here's how we'll know if it was really terrorism or not. If it was really terrorism, the U.S. government will say, you know what? We'll pick up the insurance cups the way they did on 9/11.
Right.
Don't worry your pretty little head about insurance or investigating or anything else. We'll just pay y'all off.
Right, right. A cyber attack possibility is confirmed in an April 5th article in Security Magazine titled Protecting Ships from Cyber Terrorism. The author observes, now quoting this author, the investigation into Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse has only just begun. But we've already seen news reports containing an unclassified memo from the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Research or Security Agency, or CISA, that incidentally is one of the agencies involved in the censorship industrial complex, but that's a different subject.
Well, they were too busy censoring to
Do it there. Yeah. Right, exactly. And comments from the Department of Homeland Security concerning the cause. At this time, there is no evidence that the incident was anything more than a tragic accident. But the involvement of these U.S. government agencies indicates concerns of a cyber attack.
I get it. It's just too weird to be an accident, right?
Right.
I see that people are suspicious, and you know me, I'm a conspiracy theorist. But for some terrorist group to know that the bridge was built so shoddily, and to know where its weak point was, and to be able to figure out how to take a, what is it, 31-ton ship, or I don't know, it was more than that, I think, and turn it just at the right time, at the right place, in order to take out a support that they somehow knew would take out the whole bridge, that seems kind of a complicated terrorist attack, is all I'm saying.
Well, yeah, it would be, and yet the capacity is there, as this author continues. These concerns are highly warranted. For some time, maritime cybersecurity has been on top of the mind for regional, national, and global policymakers. There are plenty of onboard systems to attack. Hackers are known to intercept satellite communications used extensively by ships at sea. They can also spoof or jam GPS systems, manipulate the automatic ID system, steal vital data, or inject malware or ransomware into any number of onboard systems via infected devices files. Such attacks can throw a ship off course. When combined with a compromised propulsion system, the consequences can be horrific.
I can believe all that, and I do believe all that. They can do all that. But the timing and the knowledge that this was a weak point, That's something different.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just throwing the ship off course, okay, you could do that. But throwing it off right at that point, just in the right way, that's a big deal.
Right. Somebody would have really had to have worked on this for a while.
Yeah.
The cyber attack possibility is also confirmed in an article in the Security Ledger titled Container Ships Easy to Hack, Track, Send Off Course, or Even Sink, Security Experts Say. She's got a link there. In fact, training is now offered at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology to prepare for cyber attacks. An article in Norwegian SciTech News titled, What Do You Do If a Hacker Takes Over Your Ship? Begins with this chilling scene involving the hijacking of a ship's steering. You're on the bridge with the ship's course shown on the digital display. But why is the ship continuing to turn west? Everything looks normal on the computer screens in the dark wheelhouse. But outside, the land is dangerously close. What's going on? Down in the engine room, workers report via radio that everything is normal, but they wonder why the bridge hasn't changed course. The engines are revving and the ship is picking up speed. The engine room hasn't done this. What now?
Well, see, now they're assuming that the electricity is still on. How do you do a cyber attack without electricity?
Right,
is what
right.
I'm saying.
Yeah.
That's a biggie. I don't know. Maybe it was.
Well, they
do wasn't.
Have these redundant systems. Maybe they just tacked into that. Who knows? It was certainly a sophisticated operation, if that is what it is.
If that is what it is. It was amazingly sophisticated.
Yeah.
And required knowledge and precision. And how did they know how the tides were going to be and the speed of the river? How would they know all that, right? It all depends on rainfall. And, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They would have had to factor all that into there. It just seems unlikely to me.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, she also has a paragraph talking about how the World Economic Forum was talking about the increasing danger of this kind of cyber attack. And of course, well, that right there is kind of suspicious.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they tend to predict things, and I put that in quotes, before they actually happen. But anyway, hopefully the Key Bridge strike was an accident, as most news outlets contend. But whether it was or not, we have serious weaknesses in critical infrastructure that need to be addressed. Bridges such as the Key Bridge are classified as fracture critical by the federal government, meaning that if one component of the bridge's primary structural frame fails, all or most of the span will collapse.
Oh, so that was known.
That was known.
Okay. Well, yeah. I don't know. It is suspicious that the media is all denying that it's a possibility. Right there, that makes you think, huh.
Yeah, and even the corporate media has been talking for years about how America's infrastructure is in bad shape and needs major repair. And this article confirms that. There are more than 16,800 such bridges in the U.S., according to the Federal Highway Administration. According to the American Society of Civil Engineers and the federal government, 46,000 U.S. bridges have aging structures and are in quote-unquote poor condition.
That's just great.
Yeah.
Staff for bridges.
The Dolly was 980 feet long, nearly twice the length of the ships used when the bridge was built during the 1970s. To minimize the potential of ships bringing down bridges, say experts, they need to be fortified with dolphins and other structures to protect around their danger points. And that is just for the bridges. We also have a deficient electrical grid, aging dams and power facilities, and much more that are vulnerable to attack or structural disintegration. In the last of its report cards, which come out every 4 years, the ASCE, that's the American Society of Civil Engineers, in 2021 said that total U.S. infrastructure needs were approximately $5.937 trillion. Of that sum, $3.35 trillion was funded, but still leaving a wide funding gap of more than $2.5 trillion. Where will this money come from? The federal government is $34.6 trillion in debt, and the Government Accounting Office is recommending cutting rather than expanding the budget. We need a workaround that avoids tapping federal coffers.
Well, you know, a lot of our infrastructure, including electrical, bridges, post office, I mean, we've talked about this before, happened in the New Deal.
Right.
So we're talking during the 30s. So that is pretty aging. But on the other hand, why could they do it back then? Unemployed people, things that need to be done.
Right.
This is like a match made in heaven. Put those people to work building the things we need built, fixing the things that need to be fixed. But no, we can't do that.
Yeah.
Well, instead, let's go over there and try and take Russia's money.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, wealth.
Well, Ellen Brown now turns and talks about some potential solutions here, writing that that brings us back to the War of 1812 and the financial challenges successfully overcome by our forefathers. At the end of the American Revolution, the colonies turned states were $44 million in debt, a sum that at the time seemed impossible to repay. But Alexander Hamilton, the first U.S. Treasury Secretary, turned the debt to advantage by using it to capitalize the first U.S. bank. Debt securities were traded for shares in the bank, paying a 6% dividend. The bank then issued the first U.S. currency, leveraging its capital into credit on the fractional reserve system. But the bank was controversial, and in 1811 its charter was allowed to expire, right before the War of 1812.
I read her book, The Web of Debt, and she criticized Hamilton for that, for taking the debt and instead of just writing it off, because it was owed a lot to the city of London.
Right.
He said, oh, no, it all has to be paid back. And they took the continental dollars that they had issued to pay for the war, and they said they're not worth anything anymore.
Yeah. Well, I think she did criticize that, but I think she's pointing out that there is another option even now.
Well, I'm just saying.
Right. I mean, ultimately, real monetary reform, where the U.S. spends money into circulation, as you pointed out at the beginning of the program, is the real solution, which she advocates.
Yeah.
But I think she's calling attention to still other options. She says that then as now, back referring to 1811, a major issue was disruption to foreign trade. As recounted on the Federal Reserve's website, in the years leading up to the War of 1812, the U.S. economy had been on the upswing. The war with Britain, however, disrupted foreign trade. As one of the United States' largest trading partners, Britain used its navy to blockade U.S. trade with other nations. The war prevented U.S. farmers and manufacturers from exporting merchandise, blocked U.S. merchants and fishermen from sailing the high seas, and curtailed federal government revenues, which were derived mainly from tariffs on the trade. By 1815, the United States found itself heavily in debt, much like it had been at the end of the Revolutionary War 30 years earlier. In April 1816, President James Madison finally signed an act establishing the Second Bank of the United States. The tale is contained in a 2018 article titled America's Stunning Growth Under the Second National Bank. John Quincy Adams' March 4, 1825 inauguration was the start of one of the most intense periods of economic progress in history. Canals and roads were pushed through, opening up the West to settlement, funneling new mined coal to shops and cities, and creating entirely new Midwestern centers of industry. The iron industry, under tariff protection, was reborn after a century of imperial suppression. Railroads began military design construction and grew quickly from nothing to thousands of miles. Financing and planning of these enterprises was coordinated by federal, military, state, and local authorities. The Bank of the United States drove the program forward with credit regulation that throttled down parasitical speculation and directed public and private investment funds into infrastructure and industry. Researchers affiliated with the bank military government leadership team did pioneering work with engines and electricity that led to spectacular advances later on. Achievements included the Erie Canal and other canal networks connecting mining with manufacturing centers and Atlantic ports before the railroad era. In later years, the Bank of the United States sponsored creation of the Reading Railroad. The American coal mining industry began as a direct result of these projects. What Senator Henry Clay and Lincoln's economic advisor Henry Carey called the American system of government-issued money and credit was used again by Lincoln's government to win the Civil War and to fund substantial post-war development, including completion of the Transcontinental Railroad linking both ends of the country. And of course, that's getting into the greenbacks. That was the government-issued money directly.
Right.
That's
why there was a greenback party when the Big Depression hit and millions of people were unemployed and they didn't have an unemployment insurance. They started the Progressive Party, the Greenback Party, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But she continues talking about this kind of alternative bank-created system. That system was also used by Franklin Roosevelt's government under Secretary of Commerce Jesse Jones to get the country through the Great Depression and World War II.
You know, they had some really great people, not just the presidents, but the people around them. I wonder if Robert F. Kennedy Jr. knows people that are capable like this. We already know Trump didn't. He just hired from the swamp. He said he was going to drain it, and then he hired from it, right?
Right, right.
We know Biden isn't. Biden is just corrupt, and he surrounds himself with corrupt warmongers.
Yeah.
I wonder if Robert F. Kennedy Jr. would be able to recreate what Madison, FDR did.
I think so, because among his early advisors was Dennis Kucinich, and Dennis Kucinich knows about monetary reform.
Right.
Yeah. He even authored a great bill, which you can still find at the American Monetary Institute website, monetary.org.
Yeah. Well, if he put him in charge of the Treasury instead of that Janet Yellen, wow.
Yeah, that could be something.
I mean, at least somebody
he knows.
You know, Trump is running on Make America Great Again, but he didn't have the faintest idea how to.
Yeah.
You know, he just didn't know. But if someone gets in there that actually knows, and then you have to have a cabinet and you have to staff the people, you know, that do things.
Right.
You have to staff them with competent people. I mean, look at the transportation secretary we have now.
Yeah.
Seriously, he doesn't know anything about transportation. And the same with, they've got Kamala Harris in charge of border security. I mean, it's so ridiculous. Whatever.
Yeah.
I think we need someone competent in there.
Well, in any event, what Secretary of Commerce Jones did during the FDR administration was, at a time when U.S. banks were bankrupt, critical infrastructure was funded without tapping the federal budget by repurposing and greatly expanding the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, established earlier by President Hoover to save the banks. Beginning with a modest $500 million in capitalization, it lent or invested over $40 billion from 1932 to 1957.
Well, that's why we had infrastructure.
Yeah, yeah.
Except for the highway system in the 50s. that was bad for small towns. It was bad for deaths in America. Right. It was a big waste of gas, you know, stuff like that.
Right. But it was infrastructure.
It was infrastructure.
Maybe bad infrastructure.
It was bad infrastructure.
Yeah.
But up until then, the electrification and the bridges and the just everything that made people's lives better.
Yeah.
That was before.
Yeah. So the Reconstruction Finance Corporation helped rebuild the depressed economy, funded the New Deal and America's participation in World War II, and returned a net profit to the government. H.R. 4052, a proposal for a $5 trillion national infrastructure bank, is currently before Congress and has widespread support with 31 co-sponsors.
Well, that is weird. We have people in Congress who know what they're doing.
Yeah, well, 31, that's still a small minority.
It could be they just want... What do they call that? Pork?
Well, right. There is
we
that,
We should
too.
Look. If my box is co-sponsoring, we'll know it's no good.
Right. The proposed bank is designed to be a true depository bank, which can leverage its funds, as all banks are allowed to do. With a 10% capital requirement, it can leverage $1 in capital into $10 in loans. For capitalization, the bill proposes to follow the lead of Hamilton's first U.S. bank. Existing U.S. bonds will be swapped for non-voting bank shares paying a dividend. For liquidity to back the loans, the bank will use incoming deposits or will issue bonds. Included in the many projects the bill covers is electrical grid security, a major need not just for ships and bridges, but for infrastructure across the country. For more on this proposal, see the website of the NIB Coalition, that's National Infrastructure Bank, and she has a link there at the article. Our forebears fought the American Revolution, the War of 1812, the Civil War, and two World Wars to preserve our freedom and independence, the U.S. Constitution, well, right, and the Bill of Rights. Well, she's towing the line on that
yeah,
one there.
Yeah.
They kept the flag waving in our darkest hours. A Hamiltonian-style national infrastructure bank is one promising tool for preserving that vision today. And again, I think we would commend you to look more broadly at Ellen Brown's website to look at national banking that is actually setting up a national monetary system in which the U.S. itself just issues currency directly by spending it into circulation. And that's really the broader reform that Ellen Brown proposes and that you can read in most of her writings.
She also talks about the bill that they passed, the reform, right? After the bank crash, I don't know if it was the bank crash of 2001 or 2008, I forget. But they passed a reform, air quotes, in which next, it must have been 2008, because next time instead of the government bailing out the banks when they crash, you, the depositor, will bail out the banks. They will just take your money and tell you, well, now you have, you know, a chit. You can't actually turn it in for anything, but we just took all the money that you have worked so hard to save for your entire life, and we're going to use it to bail us out because, you know, we've been partying pretty good. We've been living high off the hog, you know, cocaine and hookers and whatever, and we spent it.
Yeah.
So now you have to pay for it. That's every bit as outrageous, even more really, than having the federal government, because the federal government, of course, can just write it all off. It doesn't directly steal from individual Americans. But if my money was going to go anywhere, I'd rather have it go to an infrastructure bank that would actually make life better for the average American.
Yeah.
Or for all Americans.
Yeah, she has an excellent article. If you go to her website at ellenbrown.com, and look at, she's got one called Defusing the Derivatives Time Bomb, Some Proposed Solutions. And there's another one going a little further back
That's
called The
I'm
Great Taking,
about.
How They Can Own It All.
The Great Taking, how
you
they
know,
can
you
own it all.
You think that you're protected by deposit insurance and so on?
That wasn't that was a New Deal thing. That was an FDR thing.
Right.
But they've destroyed everything FDR set in place.
Yeah.
All the banking reforms that kept them honest until the 70s. Gone,
yeah.
Especially under the evil Reagan and the evil Clinton. Just gone, gone, gone. And now you wonder why the banks keep crashing and the taxpayers keep bailing them out. That's because all the reforms are gone.
That's right. So again, you can go to ellenbrown.com. Highly recommend reading not just this article that we shared with you, but some of these older articles. That one I just cited was from back in October, but it's easy to find on the website. And you can also go to monetary.org to read about the American Monetary Institute and their proposals for real monetary reform. But that's all the time we have. Thanks for listening to Class Matters. We'll be with you again next Monday.